What if the way you love today was written in the first 2 years of your life? In the 1990s, when Oprah explored attachment theory on her show, therapists nationwide were flooded with calls from viewers suddenly recognizing decades-old patterns in their relationships. This wasn't pop psychology. It was one of the most rigorously validated frameworks in developmental science. Yet its implications remain startling. Your earliest relationship, the one with your primary caregiver, has quietly shaped everything from how you handle conflict to whom you choose as a partner. This invisible architecture of love determines whether you move toward others in times of stress or push them away, whether you trust easily or guard your heart like a fortress. Understanding attachment isn't just academic. It's the key to unlocking why we love the way we do. Before the 1940s, hospitals prioritized sterility over emotional needs, barring parental visits for months or years. The toll was catastrophic. Foundling home mortality reached 75% by age 2, while survivors showed severe delays. Institutionalized 3-year-olds averaged IQs of 68 versus 96 for foster children. Renee Spitz's 1947 silent film shattered medical complacency. It documented babies in a Mexican foundling home, including Jane, who transformed from happy infant to hollow-eyed and inconsolable within a week of maternal separation. Other babies appeared emaciated with bizarre movements. The contrast with thriving prison nursery babies who had regular maternal contact was undeniable. One analyst approached Spitz in tears. "How could you do this to us?" The film exposed an uncomfortable truth. Children weren't dying from disease. They were dying from loneliness. John Bowlby seemed an unlikely revolutionary. Born into British upper-class tradition in 1907, he rarely saw his parents and was shipped to boarding school at 8, an experience he later said he wouldn't send a dog to. This emotional desert made him uniquely sensitive to what children truly needed. Working with juvenile thieves at the London Child Guidance Clinic, Bowlby discovered something striking. Of 44 young thieves, 14 were affectionless, and 12 had suffered prolonged early separations from their mothers. These children stole compulsively but pointlessly. Bicycles they didn't need, baking powder, even rabbits they killed. They were stealing symbols of love. Milk, food, money, things associated with maternal care. This challenged Freud's cuppered love theory that children loved mothers simply because they provided food. Bowlby insisted attachment was a primary biological need, drawing on Conrad Lorenz's work showing ducklings attached to the first moving object they see, regardless of feeding. His 1951 World Health Organization report compared maternal deprivation to consumption of tubercular-infected milk. The message was revolutionary. Mother-infant relationships weren't pleasant amenities, but absolute necessities. Humans are born with innate behaviors, sucking, clinging, crying, smiling, designed to keep caregivers close. This wasn't sentimentality, it was biology. While Bowlby provided theory, Mary Ainsworth created the method to test it. After observing Ugandan mothers and infants, she developed The Strange Situation, a 20-minute laboratory procedure that became psychology's most widely used assessment. The setup? Mother and baby in an unfamiliar room with toys, a stranger's arrival, mother's departure, baby alone, stranger's return, and finally, mother's reunion. 3 distinct patterns emerged. Securely attached babies, 65%, explored freely with mother present, became distressed during separation, and greeted mothers warmly upon reunion. Ambivalent babies, 10 to 15%, desperately sought contact while simultaneously kicking away. Avoidant babies, 20 to 25%, appeared untroubled by separation and subtly avoided connection upon reunion, though heart rate measurements revealed significant hidden stress. Ainsworth's genius was connecting these patterns to maternal behaviors. Mothers of secure children responded more quickly to crying and held babies longer with more pleasure. Mothers of avoidant children showed more rejection, while mothers of ambivalent children were inconsistently responsive. Contrary to prevailing advice warning against reinforcing crying, mothers who responded quickly had infants who cried less by age one. Alan Sroof's Minnesota studies tracked children from infancy through adolescence, revealing how early attachment shapes development. By age two, securely attached children showed sophisticated emotional regulation and complex symbolic play. In preschool, they demonstrated exceptional social competence, forming numerous stable friendships and often serving as peer mediators. The data was striking. 76% of secure children developed stable friendships versus only 45% of anxiously attached peers. Avoidant boys exhibited disruption and bullying, while ambivalent boys showed marked withdrawal. Avoidant girls internalized distress through depression and chronic shame. Most disturbing, in all five documented cases where avoidant children interacted regularly with other anxiously attached peers, consistent victimization emerged. Bowlby explained this persistence through internal working models, mental representations guiding relationship expectations. Like an internal GPS, these models help children navigate their social world. A child experiencing repeated rejection develops models viewing others as unreliable and themselves as unworthy, creating self-fulfilling prophecies. Mary Main's adult attachment interview revealed adults' attachment patterns directly paralleled childhood categories and strongly predicted their children's security, demonstrating intergenerational transmission. Attachment patterns from infancy shape lifelong relationships. Research shows self-reliance and healthy dependence are linked. Even astronauts and mountain climbers were comfortable when dependence on others is required. Emotionally healthy young people who were both self-reliant and able to rely on others typically had loving parents who provided security while encouraging autonomy. Roger Kobach's research revealed secure teens handled conflicts better and made easier college transitions. Dismissing freshmen appeared more hostile, condescending, distant, while preoccupied students seemed anxious, introspective, ruminative, overwhelming friendships with intense emotional needs. Hazan and Shaver's 1985 Love Quiz revolutionized understanding of adult attachment. Secure adults, 55%, were happiest in relationships. Avoidant types, 25%, feared intimacy and experienced emotional volatility. Ambivalent types, 20%, reported intense roller coaster romances marked by obsessive involvement and chronic uncertainty. Despite conscious desires for different relationships, many adults repeatedly find themselves in situations mirroring early attachment experiences. This repetition compulsion reflects our unconscious preference for the familiar, however painful. Many find romantic excitement in partners displaying qualities of rejecting or inconsistent parents, fixated on recreating these dynamics in hopes of achieving different outcomes. Secure autonomous adults aren't defined by perfect childhoods, but by developing coherent reflection on their attachments. They've worked through wounds rather than remaining cut off from feelings or trapped in blame. Some transcended difficult childhoods through alternative relationships, kind relatives, friends' parents, teachers who provided different models. One father recalled his grandfather bringing him an extra blanket on a cold night. "Nobody had ever done anything like that for me before, and at that moment, I realized that not everybody was alike." Psychotherapy and close relationships can facilitate transformation. Peter Fonagy found the most important quality distinguishing secure from anxious adults is their capacity to understand what motivates themselves and others, a reflective ability unrelated to education or intelligence. Anxious attachment generates behaviors that push parents' buttons, activating disturbed aspects of their psychology. Parents often misinterpret these as rejection, when virtually all children, even abused ones, love their parents deeply. This love may become difficult to access but remains hidden like a burning sun. Your attachment style isn't destiny. The most powerful thing you can do for the next generation isn't having had a perfect childhood, it's making sense of the one you had.